Imagine, you are programming a massive, incredibly complex video game, right? Like a simulation of an entire society.
Oh, kind of like a city builder sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you want your digital citizens to behave realistically. So you write lines of code governing their behavior, and for, say, their fear of the unknown, you hard code a specific parameter, like a static 5 out of 10.
Right, a fixed constant.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter what happens in the game, whether there's a sudden gold rush of prosperity or, I don't know, a terrifying alien invasion, the citizen's underlying baseline fear level always remains exactly at a 5.
Well, in software development, you'd call that a fixed constant, yeah. But in macroeconomic modeling, we actually call it a deep structural
A
parameter.
deep structural
You're
parameter.
right. It's the foundational math that basically governs how the simulated humans are allowed to react to their environment.
And if you're building a video game, a fixed fear parameter is completely fine. But what if you were using that code to steer the real global economy?
Then you have a pretty massive problem on your hands.
You really do. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're looking into a 2018 Economics Letters paper by Orhan Aram Atisoğlu and Orhan Turul. It's titled Optimal Ramsey Taxation with Endogenous Risk Aversion. And our mission for you today is to explore how tweaking just one line of code regarding human psychology completely overturns decades of established economic doctrine.
Yeah, and to really appreciate the sheer scale of what this paper dismantles, we have to look at the macroeconomic rules that were already in place.
The status quo, basically.
Exactly. For a very long time, public finance economics operated under this massive, sort of unshakable mathematical proof from the 1980s. It's known as the Chamley-Judd result.
Right, so let's lay out that status quo.
Yeah.
The Chamley-Judd result basically states that in a standard representative agent setup, which is where you model the economy by looking at one mathematically average household, the absolute best optimal capital income tax rate in the long run should be 0%.
Not just low, mathematically zero.
Which sounds crazy to a lot of people today.
It does, but I mean, the core intuition behind Chamley-Judd makes a lot of sense when you map it out over time. Taxing capital means taxing the returns on investments, machinery, savings.
Right.
So if a government taxes capital today, they're fundamentally discouraging saving and investment for tomorrow.
Because it eats into the return.
Exactly. And over an infinite time horizon, that distortion compounds heavily. It leads to less innovation, less infrastructure, just a smaller overall economy.
And worse outcomes for everyone involved.
Right. So the mathematical consensus was really clear. Let capital grow tax-free in the long run and fund your government services by taxing something else, like labor.
It's an elegant proof, I'll give it that.
Yeah.
But here is the flaw in the engine of that proof. The standard real business cycle models, the RBC models that economists use to run these simulations and arrive at that 0% rule, they treat human risk aversion as one of those deep structural parameters we talked about.
A video game code.
Yes. The math literally assumes that human appetite for financial risk is state and time invariant.
Meaning the models treat risk aversion the same way physicists treat the speed of light or gravity. It's just a constant.
Right.
Whether the economy is booming or completely crashing, the simulated humans always feel the exact same baseline level of financial anxiety.
But human psychology isn't gravity. It shifts. And the authors of this paper bring the receipts to prove it.
They really do. They bring in major empirical studies to provide a reality check on how real humans behave. They point specifically to research by Amamendier and Nagel in 2011 and Giuliano and Spilimbergo in 2014.
Good studies.
Yeah, these studies bypass the theoretical math completely and just look at lived human experience. And what they found is that real human risk aversion co-moves countercyclically.
Okay, meaning our fear moves in the exact opposite direction of the broader economy.
Fundamentally, yes. When economic output exceeds its natural levels and, times are good, people become significantly less risk averse.
They feel safe.
Right. They take chances, they start speculative businesses, they buy volatile stocks, they embrace the unknown. But during severe negative economic shocks like recessions, world wars, or major market crashes,
People become terrified.
significantly more terrified of risk, yeah.
The Amamendier-Nagel study actually called this the depression babies phenomenon.
Ah.
Basically, if you experience a catastrophic macroeconomic crash early in your life, your appetite for financial risk doesn't just dip temporarily, it's deeply scarred.
Yeah, you might spend the next 50 years stuffing cash under a mattress because the environment fundamentally changed your psychology.
Exactly. Our personal risk preference is not a constant, unchanging trait. It is a highly sensitive reaction to the macroeconomic weather outside our window.
Which is such a deeply human reality.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if empirical evidence so clearly proves that human beings change their risk preferences based on the economic weather, why have macroeconomic general equilibrium models ignored this reality for so long? I mean, economists aren't ignorant. Why keep the code static if everyone knows human fear fluctuates?
Well, honestly, it comes down to mathematical survival.
Survival.
Yeah. Standard real business cycle models are incredibly delicate, interconnected systems of equations. Every variable interacts with every other variable in this continuous feedback loop. Solving a dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium model is notoriously difficult, even under the absolute best conditions.
Wow. Okay. So if you take a foundational deep parameter, something that's usually just a hard-coded number like 1.5 in the math, and you suddenly turn it into a moving target, the math gets exponentially harder to solve.
It introduces intense mathematical friction. The static assumption wasn't maintained for decades because economists genuinely believe humans were emotionless robots.
Right.
It was maintained because making the psychology dynamic threatened to break the solvability of the models entirely. Changing it meant you might not get an answer at all.
You would just crash the simulation.
Basically, yeah. And that is why Ateshilalu and Turul's approach in this paper is such a heavy lift. They decided to stop relying on the easy static assumption and actually do the hard math.
Well, let's get into their experiment then. How did they actually rebuild the model to account for real human behavior?
So they started with your plain vanilla RBC economy. You've got households working and consuming, firms producing, and a government needing to finance its spending. But instead of hard-coding risk aversion, they formulated the risk aversion coefficient as completely endogenous.
Meaning it's generated from within the shifting dynamics of the system itself, rather than being imposed from the outside as a fixed rule.
Exactly. Conceptually, they created an inverse function for the risk aversion parameter, which in the math is represented by the Greek letter sigma. And they tied sigma directly to output deviation.
Output deviations. So how the economy is actually doing.
Right. The mathematical formula dynamically updates the household's fear based on how far the current economic output strays from the baseline natural level. So if a recession hits and output drops below baseline, sigma automatically goes up. The simulated households instantly become terrified.
And if output spikes above baseline, sigma drops and the households get financially brave.
That's the mechanism, yeah.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Once they hit run on this newly dynamic, psychologically realistic model, the canonical Chamley-Judd result completely shatters. The mathematically optimal capital tax rate is no longer 0%.
It falls apart entirely. And to really understand the mechanism of why that happens, we have to look at this economy through the perspective of the Ramsey planner.
Right, the Ramsey planner.
Yeah.
That's a concept used in economics to represent a hypothetical, perfectly benevolent policymaker.
Yeah, a theoretical ideal.
Right. This planner has full visibility into the entire economy. They see the whole board, and their only job is to find the absolute, mathematically optimal allocations to maximize the overall welfare of society.
Yes. And under the old static rules, the Ramsey planner looked at the math, saw the compounding distortions of taxing investment, and concluded that capital taxes must be zero.
Because long-term growth was the only variable that mattered.
Exactly. But under this new model, where households react emotionally to the business cycle, the Ramsey planner runs the numbers and realizes they actively want to choose a positive capital tax rate in the long run. They need the tax to maximize welfare.
Wait, I need to stop you there, because this seems totally counterintuitive to me. If a recession hits, output drops, and households become incredibly terrified of the future, wouldn't applying a capital tax just punish them for being scared? I mean, why on earth does the benevolent Ramsey planner think taxing their savings is the right medicine during a panic?
That is the crucial question, and the answer lies in the concept of precautionary savings.
Okay.
When households become terrified during a downturn, their instinct is to hoard capital. They stop consuming today to build a massive financial fortress for tomorrow.
Which, you know, makes sense for the individual household trying to survive.
It makes total sense individually, but macroeconomically, it's a disaster.
Because no one is spending.
Right. The Ramsey planner sees the whole board. The planner knows that if every single household simultaneously stops consuming and hoards capital, aggregate demand collapses, the recession deepens, and the economy gets trapped in this massive downward spiral. The decentralized households just don't internalize the societal damage of their panic-induced hoarding.
Ah, I see. So the capital tax isn't a punishment, it's a disincentive.
Exactly.
The Ramsey planner uses the tax on capital to intentionally make hoarding less attractive, effectively wedging the households out of their panic and pushing that money back into immediate consumption to keep the economy moving.
You hit the nail on the head. Making risk aversion endogenous creates brand new wedges in the economy.
Wedges?
Yeah. In macroeconomics, a wedge is basically a friction or a gap between the socially optimal outcome and what the individual household actually chooses to do. And the authors detail two specific areas where these new emotion-driven wedges appear: the intertemporal condition and the intratemporal condition.
Okay, so the intertemporal wedge is exactly what we just talked about, the trade-off across time. It's the decision between consuming a dollar today versus investing it for tomorrow. The household's spiking fear creates a massive wedge there, and the Ramsey planner uses the capital tax to correct it. What about the intratemporal wedge?
Well, the intratemporal condition looks at trade-offs within the exact same period of time.
Right, today.
Yeah. Specifically, the immediate daily trade-off between consumption and leisure. Do I work an extra hour today to earn more consumption power, or do I value going home early to relax?
Okay, and in the old static model, the value of your free time versus your wage was relatively stable. But with this new endogenous wedge, because your underlying financial terror is tied to the macro economy, the math of how much you value an extra dollar versus an extra hour of sleep is constantly fluctuating.
Right. The shifting fear of the household actively distorts both of those margins, how much they work today and how much they save for tomorrow.
Let me try an analogy here to see if I have this right. Under the old Chamley-Judd model, the Ramsey planner was trying to balance a very sensitive scale, the economy, but they were doing it on completely solid ground.
Okay, yeah.
The underlying weights of human behavior weren't changing. So the math cleanly said, don't put any tax weights on the capital side of the scale.
Right.
But with these new endogenous wedges, it's like trying to balance that exact same scale on the deck of a moving ship in the middle of a violent storm. The deck is pitching up and down with the business cycle.
That's a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. And as the ship pitches, the household's shifting fear and greed act like heavyweights sliding back and forth across the scale, threatening to tip the whole thing over.
So the Ramsey planner can't just leave the capital side of the scale empty anymore. They're forced to use capital taxes like a gyroscope. A stabilizing counterweight applied against the household's shifting psychology to keep the allocation smooth while the ship is rocking.
Exactly. The tax fundamentally transforms. It goes from a necessary evil for funding government into a psychological stabilization tool.
Wow.
It corrects the inefficiencies caused by our own overreactions to the business cycle. But, you know, what makes this caper so compelling is that they didn't just stop at the theoretical math of this gyroscope.
They actually ran the numbers.
They did. They took the time to calibrate the model to find the actual numbers for the United States economy.
And getting those hard numbers required addressing another notoriously difficult macroeconomic problem, which is how do you mathematically measure the pain of working? Because they ran the U.S. simulation using two completely different views on how humans experience labor.
Because labor is very tricky to model. The first view they tested is called convex disutility over supplied labor.
Okay.
Which is a fancy way of saying that the pain of working curves upward the longer you work.
Roughly.
So working your 10th hour of the week feels fine. Your 40th hour is tiring. Your 80th hour is absolute agony.
Yeah, I mean, most of us experience our jobs exactly like that. But the real world is also constrained by structural realities. Which brings up the second view they tested, right? The Hanson-Rogerson idea of indivisible labor.
Yes, which implies a linear disutility.
So what does that mean practically?
The concept here is that you can't easily choose to reduce your work week by exactly 2.4 hours when you get stressed. Labor is often indivisible. You are either working a full-time shift or you're unemployed. It's a rigid on-off switch.
Right. You can't just tell your boss, hey, the economy is scary. I'm only working 36 hours this week.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that in the old static baseline models, the debate over how to measure labor barely mattered for the tax question.
Really?
Yeah. Whether you use the convex model or the indivisible linear model, both simulations demanded a 0% optimal capital income tax. The Chamley-Judd result held firm regardless.
Wow. But then they flipped the risk switch. They turned on endogenous risk aversion and let the simulated households emotionally react to the U.S. business cycle.
Right. And the results are striking. Under the convex disutility model, the optimal capital income tax jumps from 0% to a sizable 11.3%.
11.3%. Just from that one change. That is a massive structural change to a tax system purely based on acknowledging human emotion.
And it goes even higher under the second scenario. When labor is treated as indivisible, that rigid on-off switch we talked about, the households have fewer margins to adjust their lives when they get scared. They can't just work a few less hours, right? So they have to rely even more heavily on hoarding capital to self-insure. And because of that, the Ramsey planner needs a bigger tax sledgehammer to stop the hoarding.
And fix the wedge.
Exactly. In that scenario, the optimal capital income tax shoots up to 16.6%.
16.6% from an absolute mathematical rule of zero. So what does this all mean? For you listening, this highlights just how sensitive the economic policies governing our lives really are, how your investments are taxed, how government revenues are generated, the broad incentives for capital versus labor. I mean, these massive societal decisions rely entirely on the underlying assumptions of macroeconomic models. And if those models fail to accurately reflect actual human psychology, the policies they generate can be wildly disconnected from what society actually needs.
It's true. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this paper serves as a profound proof of concept for the integration of behavioral economics into macro policy. I mean, if human risk aversion isn't a constant, and we now have the math proving that making it dynamic changes the tax code by 16%, it demands we scrutinize all the other deep structural parameters.
Oh, absolutely.
How do we discount the value of the future versus the present? How do we value our own time? Those likely aren't static constants either.
It makes you wonder how many other absolute rules of economic public finance are just waiting to be overturned. You know, just the moment someone figures out how to inject a dose of psychological realism into the equations. Adesha, Olu, and Turul prove that the math can handle the messy, shifting reality of human emotion, as long as economists are willing to put in the grueling work to solve for it.
Yeah, because when you build models that assume humans are emotionless, static robots, you get tax policies that are only optimized for robots.
That is perfectly said. Which leaves us with a final thought for you to explore on your own. We like to think of our personal risk tolerance as a core defining trait of who we are. You might view yourself as a naturally aggressive investor or a fundamentally conservative saver. But if this empirical data holds true, if our deepest, most foundational appetite for financial risk is intimately tied to the broader economic cycle swirling around us, are we ever truly making independent financial choices?
That's a little unsettling.
It is. Or is your personal financial personality, the way you choose to handle your money, just an automatic echo of the business cycle?
It fundamentally challenges how much autonomy we actually have over our own economic choices.
It really does. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.